The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hey, folks, and welcome to Typology, the show in which we explore the story of you through the lens of the Enneagram. My name is Anthony Skinner, producer of the show, and I'd like to welcome the host, Ian Cron. Ian, how are you doing?
I am remarkably well.
Hey, we were just in Dallas. Let's talk about that.
Well, that was a great 24 hours, wasn't it?
It was, yeah.
You and I, my son Aiden, we went out to Dallas so that I could do a live podcast with The Minimalist.
Yeah, man.
Our friends Josh and Ryan.
Love those guys.
I do too. What a fun night.
It was. We were at the Improv.
Yep.
In Dallas, Texas.
Yep. From a couple hundred people. And they interviewed me for about 45 minutes. Yeah. And we just had the room was buzzy and it was a really, really fun night. And
it really was. Yeah.
It was really the first stop on an early stop on a tour for my new book.
Come on. Let's talk about it. Hold it up.
Right, so this is, by the way, the uncorrected proof. It's right. In soft cover because it's a galley.
Called a galley.
And this goes out to, you know, major publications for reviews and different people that we hope will dig it and talk about it. But so it will be in hardcover and much fancier. However,
yes,
the story of you, an Enneagram journey to becoming your true self. It drops on December 28th, but you can pre-order it now.
Yes.
On Amazon, which I encourage people to do.
Yep.
I am so pumped for people to get their hands on this book and to start this new chapter of conversations.
And you can go to ianworkingcron.com/thestoryofyou as well.
Mm-hmm.
Can you give just a little primer on what it's about? Because I'm pumped about this, by the way. I mean, I've actually been able to read the book. I'm super excited about it. So here's
a premise for you.
Yeah.
You know, I think all of us live in stories,
mm-hmm.
right? All of us has a narrative or a story we tell ourselves about who we are.
Right.
And who we tell others who we think we are.
Mm-hmm.
Right. We really acquire this story as a little person.
Yeah.
Right. And that story actually comes to define us,
mm-hmm.
and it actually, in many ways, shapes our personality.
Right.
Right?
We act out of it sometimes knowingly and many times unknowingly.
Yes.
Yeah.
Now, the problem is, mm-hmm. in this broken world, is that many of us end up in broken stories.
Right.
And those broken stories may have helped us as little kids to understand what was happening to us,
mm-hmm.
but it's so sad. Some people bring early childhood, broken, mistaken stories about who they are, what their value is, about what the world is like into adulthood.
Right.
They never get rewritten.
Right. Right.
They never get edited.
Right.
They just drag them with into adulthood and they're trapped in the wrong narrative. It makes them unhappy. It distorts their personality. I've seen people stuck in bad stories. Mm. That has ruined their lives.
Right. Yeah.
It's ruined their lives.
Yeah.
And so what I'm excited about is when I get to tell a person, you know, you don't have to stay in that old story.
Right.
It's broken.
Yeah.
Right. You have the freedom to rewrite the narrative of your life. Now,
it's so exciting to me.
Now, here's the kicker.
Yeah.
I think that the 9 Enneagram types, yes, they are personality types.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say that they're 9 stories that people acquire as little people, right?
Mm-hmm.
And live in without any sort of knowledge that some of it is not going to work for you.
And now, so what argument would you say, because I know you have one, to people that say only 9 stories?
Yeah. So, you know, in literary criticism, it's interesting.
Yeah.
There's a very thick book. It must be 1,300 pages. It's called The 7 Basic Plots. I mean, in literature and film, critics, right? I mean, literary critics, highly educated people, many of them would say there's only 7 basic plots in all of literature.
Yeah. Right? Every book you've ever read, every movie you've ever watched.
Yeah. Yeah. There are tragedies, there are comedies, there are romantic comedies, right? There's right. drama, whatever it is.
Yeah.
And you know, by the way, when you watch a romantic comedy, you know how it's going to roll.
That's right.
But it doesn't stop you from watching it.
That's right.
Right? You yeah. you know that, that different stories have different runs.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's not a surprise that maybe there are nine stories, but let me put it how I would say it be this way.
Yeah.
These nine stories appear so often in the human population that we should pay attention to them.
That's good.
I don't know if they're the only nine stories. All right. I know is that you see them so often that we should, you know, take them seriously. And so, look, I'm not saying that your personality type is wrong. What I'm saying is that pretty much everybody lives in a broken story.
Right.
The Enneagram can help you find out what that yeah. story is and how you can rewrite it.
And the cool thing is this book helps illuminate the broken story that you're in.
Yes.
And how to rewrite your story.
Yes.
I love it. I love it.
Yes. And so, you know, we have a little model in the book. It's called SOAR. And I know some people hate acronyms. I hate acronyms. But here's the deal. I've learned from 12-Step Recovery that acronyms can save your life. Okay.
Right.
Like we have one in 12-Step HALT, right?
Right.
Don't get hungry, angry, lonely, or tired.
Uh-huh.
Right? I just, you know, that's a great little reminder to me.
Yeah.
So SOAR is C. And to see is to kind of look back at your story.
Mm-hmm.
Like, where did it come from? What would I name it? Right? What is the old story?
Yeah.
Like, see it.
Right.
Right? And then the second is own it. And what that is just to own what it's done to you. Right? Just see the cost of the story. And then the next one is awaken. Right? And awaken is like, man, you know, again, it involves the cost. It's just beginning to have your eyes opened to these new possibilities. Rewrite is when you can say, all right, how do I unwind those parts of my story that are dragging me down, right? That are dragging me down. And I love what Mo Willems, the author, says that I love this. He says, if you find yourself living in the wrong story, leave. You know,
that's so good.
And anyway, I'm so excited for people to get their hands on the book and learn about.
Yeah,
man, I could live in a new story. And that's the exciting thing is when you tell people that, they look at you a little sideways and they go, wait a minute, you mean I'm
that's
not
right.
like fated
yeah.
or destined
yeah.
to live in this old story?
That's
like,
right.
I just thought, what can I do about it? Nothing. It's just how things happened. It's like what got done to me.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, no.
Right.
Right.
That's right.
You have the right. If you've been playing the victim or the martyr your whole life, you know you can recast yourself as the hero of that
Come
story.
On. I love that. Well, so again, we want to remind people to go to ianmorgancron.com/the story of you. That's right. Hold it up there. Take a look at it for those of you on video. And we have some more exciting things about the book that we're going to be rolling out in the weeks to come. But let's get to today's show. Man, we've got a fun guest today. John Acuff, New York Times bestselling author of 7 books, including his most recent Wall Street Journal number 1 bestseller, Finish, Give Yourself the Gift of Done. He is an INC Magazine top 100 leadership speaker, spoken to FedEx, Nissan, Microsoft, Chick-fil-A, Nokia. His latest book, Soundtracks, which he released in April, is already a bestseller, and we're talking about that today. John is a 7, and Ian asked the question when he first came into the studio, what have you been thinking today? What kind of thoughts have you been thinking? And it will blow you away. He gives real interesting insight into the mind of the 7. So he's quite an authority on soundtracks of the mind and overthinking. He actually says, overthinking is when what you think gets in the way of what you want. It's an epidemic of inaction and a tsunami of stuckness. The good news is there are simple, counterintuitive ways to turn all of that overthinking into action and reclaim time, creativity, and productivity to create the life you want. So this is a great interview. We get into all kinds of stuff. I know you're going to love this one, and I know you're going to love John. Really thrilled to have him in the studio with us today. So without any further ado, here is our guest, John Acuff, and your host, Ian Crum.
John Acuff, Enneagram 7, welcome to Typology.
Thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to it.
Man, I'm looking forward to it too, man. We haven't had a chance to spend much time together, but we run into each other periodically.
Totally.
Different conferences pre-COVID.
Coffee shops,
all of them. You got a brand new book, Soundtracks, The Surprising Solution to Overthinking.
Yeah.
Love the name.
I love it, man.
Oh,
and,
thanks.
Yeah, and here's the thing. This is a perfect conversation for typology and talking about sevens.
Good, good.
Because you all know about overthinking.
We do some of it. We definitely do some of it.
I want to know something.
Yeah.
If I got inside your head and I was listening to your stream of thought, what would it be like?
I mean, today it'd be like, man, he has cool dogs. It's nice to meet his dogs. Like, I wonder if they're related. Do those dogs know any tricks? Do those dogs know other dogs in this neighborhood? Are there other cool dogs? Or is this it? Is this a cat neighborhood? I bet somebody on this street owns a ferret. I got a ferret vibe from some of these houses. Not like a ton of ferrets, but like one ferret is enough ferrets. When it comes to fair, like things like that, or like, how did I park? Could I have parked better? Was that, I should have parked closer, but I have a park at the first spot you see as if it's the last spot that will ever exist. And since I'm by myself, I was like, I'm going to do the walk and then I can get more steps in and then I can compete with my daughter in the step challenge for the week because she's doing cross country. So yeah, it would be like that. That's a snippet.
I'm exhausted.
Wow. Right?
That's amazing.
Sevens, man.
You are... Five, sixes, and sevens. All of you are in the thinking triad. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes, you know, sevens will, they can be really affectionate.
Yeah.
Right? All that optimism and that stuff can, and so you'll think, man, how can they be in that thinking triad? But y'all are thinkers, man.
Yeah. I mean, the regular triad sounds cooler because you get Japanese tattoos and stuff, but I feel like, you know, the thinking triad, I don't know if Yakuza?
Ian just raised his forearm and showed us his tattoo.
Yeah. Is that new or old?
Oh, it's years old, a couple years old.
It looks pretty new.
No, it's about, I don't know, 3-4 years old or something like that. Right. Yeah. Just goes to show, you know, I wasn't drunk.
Yeah.
You know.
Every listener right now is like, I wonder what, it's barbed wire around his arm. It's kind of, think Panama City Beach, but slightly not as classy.
Think six margaritas in Panama Beach.
This is why he speaks in long sleeves. A lot of people don't get to see those Ian arms, as they call them.
Yeah, right. Well, that's also because in the corporate world, I'm always wearing long sleeves, you know, when I do corporate gigs. Yeah, and it's like... It's 300 degrees in the room.
Oh, yeah.
Why is he wearing a long sleeve shirt? Everyone's in golf shirts. Yeah.
I wear sport coats because then I don't have to iron the shirt. It's one of the hardest parts of public speaking is wrinkles. And so like when I show up at a hotel and I'm like, oh man. And there's no way to fold the shirt where it doesn't look like it was an accordion.
Right.
So now I just wear like sport coats over it and a complicated pattern because that'll hide wrinkles. But sometimes I'll show up at events.
And it looks great on a Jumbotron.
I've had this 5 times happen. Show up at the event and I'm wearing the shirt they have in the photo. So there's a photo of me before I speak. And it looks like this poor kid, he's just out here trying to earn a second shirt. He's just out here tap dancing for nickels, trying to get himself someday, dare to dream, a whole second shirt just for me.
But it's the only shirt you ever had custom made. And that's why you wear it every single time, right?
Yeah.
All right, let's get back to the book here, number 7 on the Enneagram. We've now gone off into about 16 different tangents, all of which I enjoyed enormously.
Sure.
But I really do want to talk about this book. And in part because I've been doing a lot of thinking about thinking, if you will. You know, as a therapist, I'm always trying to help myself and other people make sense of or realize that their mind is out of its mind.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
It
just is. Mm-hmm. Right? We have 50 to 80,000 discrete thoughts every single day.
Mm-hmm.
That's just, you know, according to, you know, science, you know, it's like, well, that's about, and most of them are repetitive.
Mm-hmm.
And most of them have a negative bias.
Yeah. The phrase I use in the book is fear comes free, hope takes work. You never have to go out and try to find a negative thought. Like, it'll find you.
Yes.
You know, one of the things that came up in the research is that in the English language, there's not a good opposite for the word trauma. Where you say, this is a word that means overwhelming joy that hits you out of nowhere and stays with you for years and years and years and years and years. And so that, you know, I your brain will pick up stuff and remind you of stuff you did wrong 5 years ago. I mean, mine the other day reminded me of a birthday party that I had ruined because I ruined the surprise. And my brain was like, hey, remember 20 years ago when you worked with Tara and you ruined her husband's surprise party? Let's think about that while we're shopping for groceries.
Yeah, exactly. Like,
hey, that's not helpful.
And you know, those, as you were just saying, you know, that those thoughts then dictate the moodscape, right? Mm-hmm. How we feel right in the moment, which then determines how we act.
Yep.
Which then reinforces how we think, mm-hmm. right? And then we just get into these unvirtuous cycles, right? Not good.
Well, and then your brain, I mean, with cognitive bias, starts to say, I'll go find examples of this thing you already feel. Right. So somebody the other day told me, I was talking to them about soundtracks and said, I think one of my broken soundtracks is I've been saying, I'm old. And I've started to notice, wow, I forgot that. Or wow, I'm slower. And I said, yeah, you've just given your brain an assignment. Right. The more you say I'm old, it starts to go, let's believe that. Let's really believe that. Right. All with cognitive bias, find proof of that because the brain likes to believe what the brain already believes and it just kind of spirals.
Right. Wow. Absolutely, that's good. It is good. And I do think that one of the major tasks for people in our contemporary world is decluttering the mind. Mm-hmm. We had the Minimalists on recently. And I got to talk to him. I said, you know, one of the places people need to practice minimalism is in their dang heads.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Right? It's just too much thinking. Thinking is overrated.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways.
The thing I've been telling people is we asked the PhD, this guy Mike Peasley, who helps me with research, we asked 10,000 people if they struggle with overthinking. 99.5% of people said yes. I mean, we got survey responses where people would go, I couldn't finish the survey. It had 5 or 6 questions. Right. And that was before 2020. 2020 was catnip for overthinking because everything is a thing now. So like the other day, I met somebody and they went to shake my hand and I thought, should I refuse? Should I fist bump? Should I twist at the waist and give them an elbow instead? Should I shake their hand and then immediately put my whole arm into a vat of hand sanitizer as if to say, excuse me, while I wash off this deadly pandemic you just tried to murder me and my grandparents with? Then I started looking around the room. Are there people shaking? What does that say about us politically? Like, do you know what I thought 2 years ago when somebody shook my hand? Nothing. I just shook their hand. But now everybody, even if they weren't an overthinker before, has now have extra layers of thought on every single social interaction because of the last 2 years we've just experienced.
Right. So what do we do, John?
Well, there's a number of things we can do. I mean, I think one thing is starting with understanding you can choose your thoughts. I would argue most people don't understand they have that power or that permission. They think a thought is something that shows up on its own. It's something I have, not something to hone. Even my most type A, my eights, or my ones, whatever, are like detailed and they lay out their clothes the night before they go to the gym. They don't pick out their thoughts before a big meeting. I rarely meet somebody who goes, you know, I got the big meeting on Thursday and I had a similar meeting go poorly and I know I picked up some broken soundtracks from that. I don't want those playing in this and ruining it because I got this soundtrack that they're trying to take advantage of me. I don't want that to spoil the business deal. So here's the 3 soundtracks I'm going to listen to internally when I'm in this meeting. We just let thoughts show up. So I think the first thing is recognizing you have the ability to choose your thoughts. You have the permission to do that. And then once you understand that, it opens up all these really practical tips and tools you can use.
Okay. Do you have, in the language of soundtracks, and we all have mental soundtracks,
sure,
for sure, top 10 hits?
Well, I mean, top 10 hits, one would be Who Am I to Do That? Like, you know, who am I to raise a kid? Who am I to write a book? Who am I to start a business? Who am I to have a podcast? Who am I to think I could move to Nashville and chase a dream? So Who Am I to Do That? Another one would be I'm Too Old. That's kind of in the family of I miss my moment, which is interesting. I always say that fear can be schizophrenic. It'll tell you you're too young, and then it'll tell you you're too old. And you go, when was I the right age? Right. Like, there was no 10-minute window when I was 32 that fear was like, this is it. You're the right age.
Right.
So either I'm too young or I'm too old is another one. Those are kind of some popular stressful ones where you go, okay, I can hear this again and again and again. But that sense of being unqualified, or another one would be, I'll make a decision when I have all the information. But we haven't lived in an all information world in 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
You have to make decisions with enough information and you get to choose that. So you see a lot of people get stuck going, as soon as I know this, this, and this, then I'll make those decisions. But those are some that I run into in various forms over and over and over again. And the language might change a little bit. Another one would be you're just lucky. That was one that I had a podcast I was on, and during the middle of the podcast, the host got quiet and I said, "What?" And he said, "Well, I just realized I have a broken soundtrack." And I said, "What?" And he said, "Well, I've been the number one podcast in my category for the last 9 months. And what I've been telling myself over and over is you're just lucky. You're just lucky. You're just lucky." He said, "If a friend came over and they had worked really hard for 9 months on something, I'd never say you're just lucky. So if I wouldn't say it to them, why not saying it to me?" Hmm. And so again, it's that sense of inadequacy. You know, we did a study. I've got thousands of handwritten soundtracks from teenagers because I spoke at these big camps and I'd ask them to write down what they were listening to. And a lot of them would say, "I'm not enough. I'm not good enough. I'm not pretty enough." And so that sense of enough. And so, and there are some positive ones, but by and like most people, like thoughts don't go healthy on their own. Like you have to steer them and guide them there. In the same way that I've never met somebody who accidentally got in shape, where they're like, I was binge watching Netflix. I just looked up. I was doing burpees. I don't even remember doing the burpees. Like you have to, if you want your mind to think good things, because the book, there's a couple things it talks about. One, your brain misremembers. Malcolm Gladwell's done amazing podcasts on that. Your brain isn't accurate. It has cognitive bias.
Well, that's one with Peter Jennings, right? Was that the podcast?
No, it was Brian Williams. Brian Williams, who thought he was on a helicopter that got attacked by a grenade. Yes.
And he defended him.
He said, "No, your brain." And so there's all these studies where people would write down where they were on 9/11 and 4 years later would say the exact opposite. And they'd go, "This is your handwriting." And they go, "I don't know why I lied back then, but now I know it's this." So that's part of it is going, I think one of the mistakes people make is believing that if they have a thought, it must be true.
Mm-hmm.
And being willing to go, wait a second. So I teach in the book, I teach three questions that I think they're, I call them Trojan horse questions because they're simple. Like the words aren't special, but when you ask them, there's truth inside. The first is it true? Is the thing I'm believing about myself, about this situation, whatever, true? Second question is it helpful? When I think it, does it move me forward or pull me back? Because some thoughts are true, but they're not helpful.
Right.
I talked to a manager of a company who said he got fired 12 years ago. And in that moment, he started to listen to this broken soundtrack that said, "You could be fired again." And then that mutated into, if I see a door close on a meeting I'm not invited to, I might be about to be fired. So let's say he has, you know, one of those situations a day. He's definitely invited to more meetings, you know, not invited to meetings, but that's 10 minutes a day. You know, 5 days a week, it's 50 minutes, you know, a week over a 12-year period. That's 6 to 8 hour work days. So is it true he could be fired? Totally. Anybody could be fired. Is it helpful to think that? It's not. Third question, is it kind? If I said it to a friend, would they still want to be my friend? And when you ask those questions, you'll be shocked how many of your thoughts aren't true, aren't helpful, aren't kind. And that's why I talk about what does it look like to retire that thought?
Mm. So did you read The Untethered Soul?
Mm.
So in it, the author talks about this idea that if you were to put your mind into a body outside of yourself and you let that person walk next to you and they talk to you the way that you talk to yourself, you would first of all think that person's crazy.
Yeah, they're a monster. That
they're a monster, and they're crazy because they're all over the map.
Yeah.
And a lot of, again, the negative cognitive bias is running, you know, and you would just be like, "I've got to get away from this person.
I need to change the locks. Like that person has keys to my house. I need to change the locks."
Absolutely. Okay. So you're an Enneagram 7.
Yeah.
The unconscious motivation of the 7 is a need to avoid distressing psychological and emotional states, right?
Yeah.
Or thoughts.
Totally.
Or situations.
Mm-hmm.
And their strategy for it, right, is through living very future oriented, right? Lots of trouble staying in the present moment.
Yeah.
Super hard, more than any other type. By entertaining escapades and adventures in their mind, planning them, thinking about them, overthinking about a world of unlimited possibilities, all in service to avoiding pain, right?
Yeah.
Pain.
I agree with that.
I
think like for me, it's like the most minor of inconveniences. So I always joke with friends if they say, "Let's go to this new restaurant." I go, what's the parking lot like? Is it street parking? Is it like one of those hipster restaurants that has 50 tables and 4 parking spaces? Like, is it?
I was in one of those last night in East Nashville.
Yeah, it drives
you
nuts.
They're all in East Nashville.
Yeah, and so like I start and they'll go, well, do you want to hear what kind of food it is? I'm like, I don't, no. Just, is it a valet? Like, what do we got going? And it's, I want to avoid the thought of the pain of, I don't know what to do in the moment. I mean, but even on a Saturday, my wife, it drives her nuts if I go, hey, what are we doing today? And she'll go, we're doing it. Like, we're in it right now. Like, I'm reading a book. You're listening to a podcast. Like, that's what we're doing. I'll go, but what are we doing next?
Right.
And so, yeah, I have to catch myself because that's me trying to prepare for the future. I look at it as like, if I do enough or have it under control, then I'll avoid the pain, whatever the perceived pain is of that moment.
Right. So we've just talked generically about, top 10 hits that people tend to, and I identify with a bunch of them. And as a 4, I can talk about mine in a moment. Mm. But for you personally, top 5 hits.
Well, I mean, one, so a negative one would be saying like, come on. Like just at random moments when I'm in between projects, like, come on, let's go. And it's not in a positive, like, you can do it. It's like, come on, get your act together. I think that's one. I was surprised during the research and writing the book how many of my sentences ended with the punctuation, you idiot. Like when I really kind of stepped into my thoughts, I was like, wait a second, that's like, where's that coming from? What is that? So that was a surprise for me of how many of my kind of soundtracks had a negative tinge. I would say another one would be, all right, just a little more. I talked to a friend of ours the other day and I said, if I want to get 10 things done and I actually accomplish 12, the soundtrack I hear is, well, then it could have been 15. So I don't get to celebrate. Wow. I 10 was the goal, but I did 12. It goes, I mean, if you could do 12, then 15. So that idea of like, just a little bit more. I would say that, that's another one. And then this sense of like, did I make the most of the opportunity? Was there something else I could have done? Like it was good, but is there a different thing I could have done? Did I maximize the opportunity? Those are some that I think that I listen to.
Is that an expression of going to the low side of 1?
It could be, or he could be a 3. Mm. And that's something we were talking about earlier. Yeah. That's the only reason I said it, right? Yeah. Was because before we started recording, you're like, yeah, I'm a 7. Everyone says I'm a 7, but boy, sometimes I think I'm a 3.
I've had a number of people go, I think you're really a 3 and you present as a 7, but you're a 3. So that's why I was curious.
Well, here's where they can get confused.
Yeah.
One is they're both optimistic.
Okay.
They're both very future oriented. Mm-hmm.
What's the main difference between a 3 and a 7?
Well, a 3 is more focused typically than a 7 is.
Okay.
A 3 will not take as many risks as a 7 will.
I don't take a lot of risks.
Okay, they're calculated risk takers because 3s are much more afraid of failure than a 7 is. Mm-hmm. Right? So the unconscious motivation of the 3 is a need to succeed, mm-hmm. to appear successful, and to avoid failure at all costs.
Huh. Yeah, see, that feels like something that for me, when I look at the risks we've taken, I haven't seen them that way because I've known, okay, here's the contingency plans. And I think, I have a hard time doing Instagram stories or YouTube because it's recorded where I can riff. I can like, but if I'm going to look
That's
embarrassed
so
and I lock up, like people go, oh, just do a quick video about, and I go, no. So I'm writing a script. I'm going to do this thing.
That's me.
Yeah.
But for a whole different reason, right? Yep. If I'm just riffing and talking, I always tell people like we're doing some project that management put before us the other day. And I was like, please let it be interview style.
Yeah.
Please. Because if you put me on a teleprompter.
Oh, yeah.
It has to be on a teleprompter because otherwise I freak out.
No, when somebody said, well, and part of it is my job is public speaking. So I get to go to all these companies and it's really fun. But my style, my presentation style, it feels natural and warm and funny. And so you could see it and go, oh, he just kind of does that. Where like they don't know I prepare like a maniac.
Yeah.
Like even if it's a speech I've done before, I do a dry run and I'm writing down with Sharp like, oh, that's a different idea. Oh, that's like, it's all prepared. And so when somebody goes, hey, just do some cool riffs on Instagram stories, I'm like, I'm going to try it 10 times, get frustrated, and then be like, I'll write a tweet because that's writing and I can, I know how to write.
Right. And all right, so let's just go back to the three thing for a second. I think that three is also tied to one, as does seven, but threes have a real perfectionist side for a different reason, right? They want things to be excellent, right? They and they also want to present well.
Yeah.
So, you know, get it right.
Well, the threes, will threes try things they know they can't win?
No.
Okay.
It's hard for them.
Yeah.
Like they have an aversion to risk.
Well, I wouldn't say I wouldn't say they have an aversion. I'd say that they're very measured and calculated about risk. So a seven makes a great entrepreneur. Threes tend to make great CEOs, right? Because that seven energy of entrepreneur, you got to be really open to risk.
Yeah.
And be like, well, it might work. It might not, but let's go for it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
No, yeah.
And the three is much more deliberate. Right. It's like, okay, well, we're gonna take a risk, but we're gonna do this, this, that, this, and mitigate the possibility of failure.
Yeah.
Right? Because I don't want to fail. Or like I have a three friend of mine, I won't tell you who it is because we share this person.
It's Garth Brooks, isn't it?
No, it is Garth Brooks. But he said, you know, he said that he took up golf and then, you know, he went in, he like took lessons 3 days a week because all the clients did, you know, and he wanted to play golf with them.
Yeah.
And then he realized after about 3 months, 4 months of three lessons a week that he was never going to be an awesome golfer. So he just gave it up.
I hired a table tennis coach. Like I did that here in Nashville.
Wow.
It's difficult in Nashville. We don't have a good table tennis community, I discovered. But my wife was like, you're a workaholic and you need a hobby. And I was like, I always love ping pong. So I didn't just buy a table. I went to the Team USA certified website, looked up the two coaches, found one, asked them both to coach me. One said he'd evaluate me. And then like a couple weeks later, I'm in some random house in Antioch while an elderly man from mainland China throws ping pong balls at me and yells, kill, kill, kill. And I was like, and my wife eventually goes, I asked you to get a hobby because you're a workaholic and you found a way to turn table tennis into a workaholic activity.
Kill, like, kill, kill.
And I'm like, oh, yeah. I mean, it was a big bucket of like, and he wasn't telling me I should kill it. He was telling me if you hit that weak stuff back to me, I would have killed it. So he was telling I would have killed that shot.
Wow.
I bought a carbon fiber handle paddle with a carry case because I'm not a chump. Like I went all the way in. Like
that's hilarious.
And so when you say your friend, at least golf, you know, like people take lessons. Like
right.
The list of people you know who have hired a table tennis coach is probably one John Acuff long at this point.
I did that, by the way, with cornhole.
You didn't hire a cornhole coach.
Oh yeah,
you went to a frat house? Like that's where you hire. That's where you hire a cornhole coach.
I did.
You know they have those like professionals on ESPN now.
They'll professionalize anything.
Oh yeah, I relapsed.
Yeah,
I got myself real drunk because the only way you can win a cornhole.
Oh yeah, yeah.
You gotta be loose.
Yeah,
you gotta be deep loose. You got to be eating like guacamole.
Oh, yeah. Distracted, yelling at your wife, Rhonda.
Yeah. Throwing up in the bushes. You got to do the whole thing.
Yeah.
Right? Well, you know, there is a real three-ish quality to you.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh.
And you have a lot of three-ish language thrown around. You know, it's amazing. As I was listening to you to self-describe how many times you were talking about doing, done. You know what I mean?
Like,
Like just all about the doing.
Yeah.
Right? All right, so we'll keep entertaining this idea that possibly a three is in the room.
I know I'm not a nine.
But I mean, just because you're funny, by the way, just because you're funny and an optimistic person, it's a stereotype that you would be a seven.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that's not a type.
But then when they get to really know me, I think they're like, oh, that like you, I have a lot of control issues. Like I want things a certain way. Like,
yes.
You know, like, and so it's. The whole thing's fascinating to me. I know I'm not a nine. I know I'm not an eight, but like seven and three is tricky to me.
And both of those are driven personalities, but for different reasons.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and sevens, are you, how distractible are you?
Very, very distractible. But like when I lock in, I set a timer And I'm like, okay, I got to write for the next 60 minutes. I'm pretty like, okay, I got to stay on this. But it's not easy.
How productivity minded are you?
Very.
Do you read books on productivity?
Oh, yeah. Constantly. I brought one with me in case I got here early. It's in the car right now.
You could work on.
Yeah, because I'm trying to read 10 pages of a success book every day in the month of August as part of a test. And so,
of a
yeah.
success book.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's three-ish.
I think we're zeroing in on it, Anthony.
Yeah.
Is your wife into the Enneagram?
No, I mean she's a five, but she would say like, I don't know what she would say I am, but she's an investigator.
Okay.
Yeah. Totally.
Y'all are different.
Yeah, very different. Yeah.
Okay. So when I say that succeeding is important, when you were a younger man, mm-hmm. how much of your self-esteem was derived from being a success?
Not a lot, but it took me a long time to kind of figure some stuff out. Like my 20s were just kind of a mess. Like I was kind of a knucklehead until like mid-30s. So it really was, and now I feel like I'm like, oh, this, like I'm starting to see the dials. I want to turn them as often and as fast as possible because I look at my 20s and I go, oh man, like I could have done more with my 20s. Or, you know, I like in college, my wife and I talk about that because we both went to the same college, Stanford University in Birmingham. And she'll go, oh, my senior year was amazing because I only had to take X amount of classes. And I go, oh, mine was really difficult because I never planned a schedule. Like I was the dude walking to 6 a.m. step aerobics class because I missed the registration for like the classes a junior should be able to take because they're a junior. And so I just kind of look at my like my high school, my college, my 20s, like I didn't do much. And now I almost feel like I'm trying to do even more because I look back at that and go, I didn't accomplish the stuff I wanted to accomplish.
And now here you are, an accomplished writer, podcaster, right? And speaker, and all that
table
stuff.
Table tennis. Aficionado.
Yeah.
But I don't even think about it like that. When somebody's like, you've written 7 books, I don't really even think about it like that. Somebody asked me, am I good at celebrating? And I was like, no, like I'm already on to the next thing. I barely. So that's something I think about.
Threes and sevens do the same thing for different reasons. So I can see where the confusion is here.
Right.
And they're both assertive types. Yeah. Whenever you want something, you just go and get it.
Yeah.
You know, or you take it.
Yeah.
One or the other. If there's an obstacle in front.
Yeah.
You know, God bless it. You know, because it's either going to get run over or run around.
Yeah.
Right. One or the other. So when you think about your personality, mm-hmm. would you say it's characterized more by gluttony, meaning, because you had a phrase earlier, just a little more,
yeah,
right, where it's like if a little is good, more must be better, mm-hmm. right, where you're just kind of like you can't find enough pleasurable experiences, interesting, fascinating experiences to jam into 1 minute? It's like you're always trying to shove them into every single minute.
Yeah.
Or is it more like a little bit like, and this could be hard because you're a public speaker, you know, is it a little bit more like your passion, if you will, is more about deceit, meaning wanting to present yourself to other people in such a way all the time that you want to win their admiration and you want them to be impressed by you and say, oh my gosh, this guy is he's the best. I mean, he's like,
yeah. I mean, I think, I don't know. I mean, I can be pretty compulsive on like, if one book is good, getting 5 books on this topic is good. Or if, you know, if running X amount of miles is good, running, you know, like I have to be deliberate to not overrun and get hurt, you know, that kind of thing. So I can definitely be compulsive. And I think there was a time when the admiration, I've moved past the time where I can surprise people, where when I was in my late 20s, like if I went and spoke at Catalyst and nobody had ever heard of me and it was a breakout and like 50 people came, it was like, wow, I've never, you know, like, but now that's my expectation. Like if Microsoft hires me to go talk to their Xbox team about performance, like I need to crush it. There's nobody that should go, oh, that was really good. Like they have that expectation. So I'm kind of like, okay, I don't look for the surprise of that anymore. But my wife and I always joke that like one of my soundtracks or narratives is Like, you're in the football stadium and the quarterback gets hurt and the coach goes, is there anybody here that knows how to throw a football? And you go, I do. And you walk down from the crowd and you win the game on a, you know, 99-yard Hail Mary. Like, that idea of, like, you're one moment away from, like, this massive thing is kind of one of the narratives that I have to push back on so that I don't get frustrated with, okay, this thing takes time. Like, books take time. You know, building a business takes time. And so, okay, what does that time look like? And how do I give myself to it versus going, I want it all to happen right now. I want it all immediately right now. That's one of my narratives, definitely.
You were a knucklehead in your 20s?
Oh, yeah.
What does that mean to me? I don't understand that.
Well, like in college, freshman year, I got a 2.4 the first semester and was gonna, because I had a Massachusetts sized chip on my shoulder. I was this Massachusetts guy, came down to college in Alabama.
I was about to say, how did you get from that? That's a different story, but yeah. Keep going.
Yeah. And so then, like, they tell me you're gonna lose your scholarships if you don't have a 3.0. So I build kind of like the perfect version of myself at Christmas, and I come back and I crush it. I get a 4.0. Like, people are like, you're like a different person. And I'm like a machine. Now I crash in the summer because I've white knuckled the whole semester. And I don't repeat it the third semester. Like, I go right back to, and I told that story forever about, like, oh, look, I was able to turn it around. And then I realized, like, maybe about 2 years ago, like, I don't like the character in that story. Like, I don't like the person. I was telling my daughter that story and I was like, ugh. Because it's also the dumbest, hardest way to get a 3.0. To have a 2.4 and then need perfection on the back end. And so that's what I mean, is like, potential was there, but I would go, you know, I would date somebody who was into raves and I'd be going to raves, you know, junior year. And like, that, nobody does super well at life when they're actively going to, like, warehouse raves until 5 a.m. You know, like, that's not a path. So I mean, like, stuff like that. And then I met my wife, but I really didn't know my career or what I could do. I was a copywriter at Bose and Staples and Home Depot, but it really wasn't until I started blogging and going, wait a second, I think I have some ideas to share. And if I pour myself into them, like, some fun stuff can happen. And so that's what I mean. I never felt like I had a path. I always felt like I was, anytime people would kind of go, hey, and this probably gets to a deeper question, hey, there's something really good that we could build with you at this company, I'd jump to another company. And then I'd wow them and they'd be like, this is amazing. And I'd get bored of that and I'd jump to another one. So I was a huge job jumper. I remember after about 6 months, I would start to every morning in the shower go, if I stay 9 months, will that look better on a resume? If I stay 13 months, I can stay more than a year. Like, I was ready. And then,
so did you get bored? Is that
bored? I feel like when you're young, you have all the confidence and none of the experience. And then when you hit your 40s, sometimes I see the flip, you have a ton of experience, but less confidence because you know what could go wrong. Mm-hmm. And so I had a ton of confidence, no experience. I think I would just get bored. But then when I started my own company 8 years ago, I couldn't quit me. Like, there was no, like, okay, I'm in a corner, jump to something else. I had to really focus and kind of be deliberate and build some systems versus just jump.
All right, let's go back to your new book, Soundtracks, The Surprising Solution to Overthinking. In your thinking mind, what role does anxiety play in it?
Well, I mean, I think it's one of the manifestations of overthinking. I don't think everyone who overthinks is anxious. I don't think that was one of the things we talked about in the book, is that it's not a personality trait. It's not like a certain type of person does it and other people don't. I think it can turn, I think it can turn into anxiety, especially if you don't. Like, what I say is, pull the thread. What's the thought behind the thought? Like, Thoughts travel in bunches. So often if you'll say, well, this is what I'm frustrated by, like, an example would be somebody says, I hate my coworker. They're unqualified. They get all these opportunities. And if you'll sit with them though, and kind of pull the thread, often it'll be that the person is really bold, or they're really confident in meetings, or they volunteer for stuff. And the person who's frustrated wants to be braver. And so a good version of that is, I get to be brave. Like, or, you know, I want to be brave too, versus going, Boris is unqualified or Mark is unqualified. So if I can get them to pull the thread, it's often there's a handful of thoughts that are kind of driving all these things. And then once you know that, you can, like I said, retire it. You can, the three things I talk about are retiring your broken ones, replacing them with new ones, and then repeating the new ones so often they become as automatic as the old ones.
Mm. So I agree. But I do think that there have to be some really intentional practices, because thoughts are incredibly powerful. So powerful that one evolutionary psychologist I know would say that you don't have thoughts, your thoughts think you. Because your brain secretes thoughts.
Oh, yeah.
Like your thyroid, yeah. You know, it just yeah. secretes thoughts. Yeah. You
like can't, a sweat gland.
Yeah, it's just, yeah. they're just going.
Yeah. Yeah.
And some of them, you know, go faster than you can watch them, right? So, you know, for me, and we talk a lot about this, we've done a podcast on it. It requires powers of self-observation.
Well, so let me give you one power of self-observation, okay. Like a simple trick people can do. It takes 30 seconds. So people say, well, how do I know if I have broken soundtracks that I need to retire? And so I always say, all you have to do is write down a desire. Write down something you want to do. I want to move to Nashville. I want to have a family. I want to ask that girl out. I want to paint, whatever. Write down a desire and then listen to your first thoughts, because every reaction is an education. So one way to identify a broken soundtrack is, I want to do this thing. And then if the first 10 things you say to yourself are why you're not qualified for that, why you're not skilled for that, why you're in the wrong city for that, then maybe there's something you should pause on and deal with that. And I also say, don't ask all your thoughts the true, helpful, kind question. Who has time for that? It's 60,000 thoughts. But it's the ones that are the loudest, the mm-hmm. ones that are neon. And it also does take time. Like what I've learned is, there's sometimes in life where a single thought, something you know, can change an entire situation almost instantly. So an example would be, if you have a difficult coworker and you just don't get along, they're so demanding, they're terrible, and you find out his wife has cancer, changes everything.
Yes.
Knowing that information changes everything. There's other times though, something's been in place for a decade. And what was interesting about the book, 48 hours after it came out, people said, I've already read it, I've already listened to it three times, and my new soundtrack isn't sticking. And I'd say, well, how long did you listen to the old one? They'd say 10 years. And I'd say, well, you gave the problem 10 years to develop and the solution 10 days. And so that's why the repetition is so important. That's why, like, one of the things in the book, we talk about symbols, that symbols have power. And the best brands in the world have known that forever. Like Yeti is a symbol. Like, people put stickers on their cars to let you know how they refrigerate things.
Right.
Nobody did that in the 90s. Nobody right. was like, igloo. Right. I'm an igloo guy. If you're ever curious about how I keep stuff cold,
I'm a Coleman guy.
And so, like, the symbol, though, I always say, like, you're up against a really strong soundtrack. It's good to tie it to a symbol. Like, and the way you do a symbol, it's really simple. It has to be personal to you. It has to be visible. And it has to be simple. And one of my favorite examples is the Lance Armstrong bracelet. The reason the Livestrong bracelet worked is, one, it was personal. No one ever said, I just hate cancer, the disease. I don't like diseases. I have an eczema necklace. I wear like disease jewelry. Nobody said that. It always was personal. It said, my uncle died from cancer. My mom. The second thing was, it was visible. Nike could have made it skin tone. They could have made it gray. They didn't. They made it bright yellow. And the third was, it was simple to use. The symbol always has to be simple. Nobody's confused by a bracelet. Nobody's like, oh, you put the arm part into the whole part. And so I'll tell people, okay, if you've got a symbol, like one for me, it was 2 weeks before the book came out. You've released books. Like, that's a crazy mental space. We are going to Jackson Hole, Wyoming with my family. And I knew that I had evidence from my past that I could be physically present and mentally or emotionally absent for moments.
Oh, yeah.
And I didn't want that to happen. So I wrote a soundtrack down that said, don't miss it. Don't miss it. Don't miss it. Don't miss it. Thought that worked on that. And then when I got to Jackson Hole, they had pine cones all over the street. And they look different from the ones I have at home. And I was present enough to notice a detail, like that pine cone is different from our pine cones. And I took it with me and it sits on my desk right now, because there's going to be other moments where I'm going to be tempted to miss something.
Right.
And that symbol helps. So a lot of the times, it's kind of like writing. I never sit down with a blank piece of paper. I always bring ideas with me. I tell people all the time, I don't believe in writer's block. I believe in idea bankruptcy. Like, if you are collecting and curating ideas, when you sit down with a blank piece of paper, they can't wait to get out there. Is it easy? Of course not. But it's the same way. I'd never tell somebody, just change a thought like a light bulb, and then you're done. Like, it's a process. It can take a lot of time. It can take a lot of activities. It can take symbols, but it's worth it. And when you start to notice that you're thinking differently, you want to do it more.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's one of the things that fascinates me here is one of the practices that has made an enormous difference in my life is a daily practice of mindfulness meditation. Mm-hmm. I sit for 20 minutes twice a day on a cushion.
Twice a day. Okay.
Yeah. Early morning, late afternoon. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I miss that late afternoon because something comes up, but generally speaking, twice a day. And what it has done is it's decluttered my mind. Mm-hmm. And when you do a regular meditation practice, you become intimately aware of what your thought stream is.
Yeah.
And you'll see patterns. And so one of the things I do when I'm in meditation, you know, I just focus on my breath. It's very, very simple, mm-hmm. right? Try to quiet the mind. Of course, the mind is secreting thoughts. They're not your enemy. Yeah. You just don't want to grab them and get, you just want, every time you get distracted and you get lost into a thought story, you just bring back your attention to the present moment, right? Mm-hmm. Right. So what I have learned is we do this thing called noting, right? Mm-hmm. So if my thought goes to, what am I going to do later today? I just look at the thought and I go planning. Mm-hmm. Or if something comes up about, you know, I had an argument with somebody, I'll go resentment. Mm-hmm. 'Cause sometimes the feeling comes up with it.
Yeah.
Right. Or if another thought comes up like, you know, geez, 20 years ago, I was a knucklehead and mm-hmm. I didn't regret. And I don't judge it. I don't evaluate it. I don't try to fix it. I don't try to do anything. I just note it. And I just start to notice how many times my thoughts migrate, my attention migrates towards certain thoughts, right? Now, the benefit of the beauty of it is that builds up the power of self-observation. Because as my mind slows all day long as a result, it does all day long. It's just not slows, it's calmer. Mm-hmm. And what it's given me is the ability to observe my thoughts in real time. And when I see them, I don't think of them as thoughts as much as I think about them as stories. Mm-hmm. It's like, okay, my brain has now launched a story. It's the I'm too old story or I'm the too young story, right? Because to me, the narrative piece is grippier for me. You know what I mean? It's like the thought is a story. Now that story can be fictional, but until you challenge it, it's nonfiction.
Well, it's going to tell you it's true.
Yes.
You're going to be like, this is.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So what I oftentimes find myself doing is just saying, okay, is this story true? Mm-hmm. Right? Because I'm locked inside of a narrative right now about who I am and my perspective on how the world works. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, let's face it. Some of our greatest authors didn't write their greatest books until they were in their 60s. Right? So that's.
John Maxwell did his first nonfiction at like 44, 45.
Yeah. So there you go, right? Those are stories. They're self-limiting, self-defeating stories mm-hmm. that we get locked into, which is part of the reason I love this book, Soundtracks, The Surprising Solution to Overthinking, because I do think in our contemporary age with its distractibility and just the way that our brain is physically mm-hmm. wired, mm-hmm. Overthinking, man, is...
Well, but think about this too. We don't give this enough conversation. Most of this stuff is new as far as the phone. Like, it's not 100 mm-hmm. years old and we now know how to deal with it. We're the pioneers. Like, people 50 years from now will go back and go, how did they first even deal with all that amount of information that they got?
Right.
I mean, for me, it just hit me the other day that other than my phone app and other than maybe the calculator, every other app on my phone is selling me something. I decided to carry around the world's largest infomercial in my pocket. Mm-hmm. Like, Instagram has 10,000 employees and their job is distract Ian. Like, that's their job. Like, whether a secretary, whether a developer, like, that's their job is to go, we want more of his attention, more of his time, which turns into more revenue. So I always try to give people I tell them this is challenging because it should be challenging. In the 1980s, you didn't have whole companies that were billion-dollar companies in the distraction business. You had newspapers, you certainly had TV and all that, but we have so much more of that. I don't think we've developed as many tools for that as things that are stealing it. Like, we haven't scaled our tools for focus or meditation or whatever with the same amount of eagerness as we have our tools for distraction. And that's why, to me, it's challenging.
Yeah.
That's good.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
I love this.
Yeah. I can't wait to read it.
I know, honestly, man. Yeah. And I love the metaphor of soundtracks because mm-hmm. we all have favorite right. soundtracks in our brains.
Yep.
Right? Well, I picked that because a soundtrack in a movie often changes the whole moment without you even noticing. Mm-hmm. Your whole body changes. I mean, there's studies about the just hearing the sound of the Jaws soundtrack changes, oh, gives yeah. you a physical change. And so, yeah, for me, it was one that I thought, okay, this is a handle. I consider my job to be a handle maker. We have enough ideas in the world. We don't have enough handles on them to pick them up and take them into our lives. And so I love to put handles on ideas. And I feel like, okay, soundtracks is a handle I think some people can pick up.
Yeah. Mm. Well, plus soundtracks and music are so sticky.
We live in Nashville. Somebody the other day said to me, why the music theme? And I was like, well, we live in Nashville. We got a little bit of that. We got a little.
Wow, man. Fantastic. This is John Acuff, author of Soundtracks, A Surprising Solution to Overthinking.
And I have you on my podcast, which is fun.
That was a ball.
That was a blast. I have a podcast called All It Takes Is a Goal, and I got to interview you about the goals you're working on and this next chapter of your life and what you've learned. And so that was really fun for me, too.
Was it coherent?
Totally. Once we got through the technology issues, I don't know if you remember that. We had a bunch of tech issues, and I don't have an amazing producer. Like I don't have a single bearded person in my office.
Redemption.
Yeah.
There you go.
There you go. Full circle. Full circle.
There you go. John, what are your Instagram handles or all of your social stuff that people need to know?
It's at John Acuff, JonAcuff. For Instagram, Twitter is the same. Acuff.me is my website. If you're like, I'd like to read the first chapter of the book, soundtracksbook.com. There's a video version, soundtrackscourse.com. And yeah, the podcast is All It Takes Is a Goal. And if you're going to listen to one episode, there's a woman named Colleen Berry who I interviewed who was a documentary filmmaker, mm-hmm. lost her job during the dot-com bust a few years ago, had to take four other jobs to survive. And one of them was as a receptionist. And she said, I'm going to change my soundtracks, change my mindset. And now she's the CEO of that company.
Wow.
And so it's a really fun receptionist to CEO story. Wow. And you know it's a good episode when you're taking notes for your own life. It's not for a question. It's going, oh, I got to. And Colleen Berry on All It Takes Is a Goal is a great start.
Right. That's powerful.
You know, when I was on John's show, he actually got up and walked away, made a Keurig coffee, and then came back. There was no note taking.
I said, Ian, tell me about the Enneagram. And then he talked for 92 minutes. I didn't say a single word. I kept trying to throw in words. And he was like, just let me go, dude.
Yeah.
I'm Ian. Yeah. You know, I have three names.
I thought it was.
Yeah, three names.
Oh, what are you rolling around with, John Acuff, too? Yeah.
No, actually, the name of the show he's on is All It Takes Is a Fool.
Oh,
and they had me on as the first episode.
I don't tell the name first. It's about experts. And you're an expert.
Yeah. Exactly.
So funny.
But, John, we want to have you back on because I'm really, I love this theme of overthinking. And Anthony's heard me talk about it a lot, about the thinking mind and about, and I'm going to turn you on to some books by some evolutionary psychologists who talk about thinking.
I'd love that.
And about negative biases. Because, you know, there was a time when some thoughts were really helpful. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm going to, being paranoid was really good when you were on the Serengeti.
Exactly, because there's a saber-toothed tiger.
Exactly. Yeah. Right? Yeah. But now, in our day and age, we don't have to worry that much about it. Right. And yet we continue to do it because our brain has not caught up to modern circumstance.
Well, and modern circumstance knows that. So that's why a news headline is written a certain way.
Exactly.
I was a journalism major. Like, I get it. And so I had to delete Twitter from my phone last year, and I still use it on my computer, but I just couldn't have that much anger in my pocket. So I had to say that's a boundary for me.
Holy crap. And it plays to what you said earlier about we haven't caught up to the fact that we have this device in our pockets, right?
Well, and the other thing is our brain is not designed to read all that information.
That's right.
It can't.
No.
When I was a kid, you got you might get the New York Times once a week.
Yeah.
Right? And you didn't know everything that was happening in Bhutan because it did not make the New York Times, right? But now, because of the 24-hour news cycle, they're running out of stories, right? So they're going to Mongolia.
I was never mad at a governor of another state in the 1990s. Like, I didn't even know him. Right. Like, I didn't even, if they were doing something terrible to people in Oregon, I had no idea.
Right.
And now I know, there's certain governors, you're man, that guy, that lady, you don't even live in that state.
Right. So, it's so interesting we were talking about this because the other day, I decided I was going to write down everything that makes me miserable.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I'm just going to write down because I found myself my brain overthinking,
yeah,
overthinking negative things. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay, this crap's got to stop. I'm just going to write down, because here's what I said to myself. And I got such a relief when I actually said it aloud. I just said, I'm miserable. I am
just admitting it.
I just admitted it. You know what?
Naming
it.
Yeah,
I'm just good. I'm a pretty miserable person inside. Mm-hmm. And you know, that wasn't an easy thing to say, but the moment I said it, I was like, okay, well now I can do something about this. Yeah. It's like, I just
How long
said
was the list?
It was pretty long. No, but it was things like the news makes me miserable.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or drinking too much coffee.
Yeah.
Makes me miserable. And yet I keep doing it. Yeah. Right. It's like it makes me jangly and crazy.
Oh, there's like me looking at certain social media accounts make me miserable. Mm. And
yes.
And my thumb is like, but we're going to go there.
Right.
Real
so,
fast.
Right. So social media can make me miserable. Mm. Right. I wrote down this whole list of things. Right. And I just made some changes. And one of them was I cannot watch the news. Mm-hmm. I cannot look at the news every day. I am going to assume that if something really important happens I need to know about, someone will mention it to me.
Well, that's the whole lie of being informed. Mm-hmm. Like, what are you doing with, like, you didn't, other than receiving misery, you didn't change your day with that information.
No.
Like, for me, that was during the middle of the pandemic. There was a news program I was watching. They had a rolling death ticker like a slot machine. That wasn't helpful. Right. And then I'd go, I wonder why I'm so, like, depressed and like, huh, it's weird. I wonder if there's a connection. Like, and I wasn't doing anything with the information. And so I just feel like we're meant to live locally, and there's some global things that we're not like comfortable with and we don't know how to live with. And so I love that you made a list of that. I think that's great.
Yeah. I guess it was about 15 or 15.
That's pretty good. I mean, I think it feels, you know, like it could be 100 some days.
Right. Well, then I had to make some changes. Yeah. Like, so I decided I was going to run in the mornings. Yeah. I don't like running in the mornings, but it's like, if I don't, I'm going to get up, I'm going to read the paper. I'm going to, or start scrolling.
What don't you like about running in the mornings?
My body is sort of like, this hurts.
Yeah. Like, what are we doing?
Late afternoon, 3:30, 4 o'clock. Yeah. My body's like, let's go.
Yeah.
Part of it used to be because I had 5 or 6 cups of coffee, like, you know, running the ship, you know,
yeah, exactly.
And it's like, okay, I'm going to go out and run 6 minute miles, you know, but you know, so I do get up in the morning, I run 10.
That's so funny.
10 minute miles, you know, whatever. Anyway, John, soundtracks, the surprising solution to overthinking. Everybody get on Amazon, go to local booksellers and check out this wonderful book about, I really sounds like, taking control of your mindscape.
Yeah.
You know?
It's 100% what it's about. Yeah. The last thing I'd say, because it was an interesting, it relates to you and the news. One of the studies we put in there was from NYU. Daniel Kahneman wrote about it.
Oh, yeah.
And they brought two groups of college students in and said, we want you to make sentences out of these word banks. And so they gave them some words and said, make sentences. First group, normal words. Second group, there were words in there hidden about being old. Words like Florida and retired and slow. And they said, okay, the second part is walk down the hall and take the second part of the test. But that's where they secretly were testing them. They tested how long it took each group to walk down the hall. And the students who had been exposed to the old words physically walked slower. Mm-hmm. Just reading words about old age changed their physical actions. And they've reversed the study multiple times. So yeah, watching the news, you might go, you're missing out. You're like, no, that's having a physical impact on you.
Oh, no, it does.
Your friends have a physical impact on you, your conversations. And so I think it's awesome when people can go, yeah, I'm gonna put some of this stuff on a diet, see what happens.
Oh, it's made a huge difference. Yeah. I mean, just a huge difference. Anthony.
Yes.
Great episode, huh?
Yeah, this is good, man. Can't wait for our people to hear it.
Is there like a best of you could already get me scheduled for or something?
But you won't be it because you didn't actually say I was the best person on your show.
I mean,
so
that
I'm
was coming later. We're still riffing on Anthony, I felt like.
But I will say you were the best person on my show to make
it's
me
a,
feel
it's
bad.
It's a collection. It's not just one person. It's like you have a highlight reel. I've seen people do that. That seems like a thing podcast.
Are you saying
do.
That I'm on the highlight reel?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, right.
I've only done 35 episodes. You can't. That's like when a band releases a Christmas album, their second album. I got to earn a highlight reel, dude.
That's hilarious.
Hey, Typology Tribe, remember these words. May you have love. May you have joy. May you have peace. May you have healing. May you have rest. Until next time.